Putting it all together, how can we use all of this to actually help us read people effectively and understand even those motivations, intentions, and feelings people may be actively trying to conceal? It's worth remembering right off the bat that detecting deception is not as straightforward as some would have you believe, and as we've seen, not as simple as spotting a telltale sign that proves a lie once and for all. Lay people and professionals alike are notoriously bad at reading body language, despite the wealth of information we now have on the topic. But the knack really comes in deciding what to do with certain observations once you've made them. Does a person's folded arms mean they're lying, unhappy about something, fearful, or just feeling cold? The trick comes in using not just one or two, but a whole host of clues and tells to form a more comprehensive picture of behavior. The reason why it's so difficult to spot a lie with perfect accuracy is that the gestures and expressions associated with deception are often not different from those signifying stress or discomfort. So given all this, is it worth learning to read body language? Absolutely. Adding this extra dimension to your interaction with others will only enrich your relationships and give you extra insight into your interpersonal conflicts and tensions. Knowing what's going on with another person allows you to be a better communicator and speak to what people are actually feeling rather than what they're merely saying. Body language signals are always there. Every person is communicating non-verbally at every moment of the day. And it is possible to not only observe this information in real time, but to learn to properly synthesize and interpret it. You don't need to be an expert, and you don't need to be perfect. You just need to pay attention and be curious about your fellow human beings in a way you might not have before. As you're developing your body language reading skills, it may help to keep a few key principles in mind. Establish normal behavior. One or two gestures in a conversation don't mean much. They could be accidental or purely physiological, but the more you know how someone normally behaves, the more you can assume that any behavior outside of this is worth looking at more closely. If someone always squints their eyes, pouts, jiggles their feet, or clears their throat, you can more or less discount these gestures. Look for unusual or incongruent behavior. Reading people is about reading patterns of behavior. Pay special attention to clues that are unusual for that person. Suddenly fiddling with the hair and avoiding eye contact could tell you something's going on, especially if this person never does either of these things normally. You may, with time, come to recognize tells in the people closest to you. They may always wrinkle their nose when being dishonest, or clear their throat excessively when they're afraid and pretending not to be. Importantly, pay close attention to those gestures and movements that seem incongruous. Discrepancies between verbal and nonverbal communication can tell you more than merely observing nonverbal communication alone. It's about context. An obvious example is someone wringing their hands, rubbing their temples, and sighing loudly, but who claims, "I'm fine, nothing's wrong." It's not the gestures that tell you this person is concealing distress, but the fact that they're incongruent with the words spoken. Gather plenty of data. As we've seen, certain constricting behaviors could merely be because one is cold, tired, or even ill. And expansive gestures may not be about confidence so much as feeling physically warm and wanting to cool off. This is why it's important to never interpret a gesture alone. Always consider clusters of clues. If you see something, note it, but don't come to any conclusions immediately. Look to see if they do it again. Look for other gestures that may reinforce what you've seen, or else give evidence for the opposite interpretation. Check to see if the behavior repeats itself with other people or in other contexts. Take your time to really analyze the whole of what's in front of you. Look for mirroring. An important thing to remember is that certain gestures may mean one thing in one context or when shown to one person, but have a different meaning in another context or with someone else. In other words, certain gestures could literally only apply to you as you speak to this person. If you're not very familiar with someone, A quick body language reading shortcut is to merely notice whether they are or are not mirroring your gestures, whatever they are. Mirroring is a fundamental human instinct. We tend to match and mimic the behavior and expressions of those we like or agree with, while we don't if we dislike a person or perceive them negatively. If you're in a meeting with a new client, you may notice that no matter how friendly your voice or how often you smile and make open-handed, warm gestures, they respond with coldness and closed gestures, failing to mirror back to you your optimism. Here, the gestures themselves are irrelevant. It's the fact that they're not shared, which shows you that the person you're dealing with is unreceptive, hostile, or threatened. Pay attention to energy. This is not some fluffy, esoteric idea. In a group, simply take note of where intention, effort, and focus are being concentrated. Watch where energy flows. Sometimes the leader of a group is only so in name. The real power may lie elsewhere. One only needs to look at how much focus and attention flows toward a baby in the room to see this in action. The baby says and does very little, yet nevertheless commands the attention of everyone there. Similarly, a family may have the father as the official leader, and he may gesture and talk loudly to cement this perception. But pay attention, and you may see that it's his wife who is constantly deferred to, and every member of the family may show with their body language that it is in fact their mother's needs that take precedence, despite what's claimed verbally. The most powerful voice in a room is not necessarily the loudest. A lot can be understood about the power dynamics in a group by watching to see where energy flows. Who speaks the most? Who are people always speaking to and how? Who always seems to take center stage? Remember that body language is dynamic. When we speak, the content of our language isn't just about the words and the grammar we use to string them together. It's about how we talk. Do we say a lot or a little? What tone of voice? Are sentences long and complicated or short and terse? Is everything phrased tentatively like a question, or is it stated confidently as though it's a known fact? What's the speed of delivery? How loud? Is it clear or mumbling? In the same way that verbal information can vary in the way it's communicated, nonverbal information can vary too. Gestures are not static, fixed things, but living expressions that move in time and space. Watch the flow of information in real time. Watch how expressions change and move in response to the environment and those in it. Don't be curious about catching a discrete gesture, but rather watch the flow of gestures as they change. For example, take a look at how a person walks. Walking is like a body posture, but set in motion. Shuffling, slow gaits suggest lack of confidence, while springy, quick ones suggest optimism and excitement. Become interested in how a person responds to others in conversation or their style of talking to those in positions of power. Once you start looking, you'll be amazed at the wealth of information that's just waiting there to be noticed. Context is everything. Finally, it bears repeating. No gesture occurs in a vacuum. Nonverbal communication needs to be considered in relation to everything else, just like verbal communication. Establish patterns and learn about a person's behavior over time, in different contexts, and toward different people. Consider the situation and environment. Sweating and stuttering during your wedding vows or a big interview is understandable. Doing so when asked to explain what you're doing snooping through someone's drawers? It's a little more suspicious. Remember that everyone has their own unique, idiosyncratic personality. Factor into your analysis the fact that people are either introverted or extroverted, may favor emotions or intellect, may have high or low tolerance for risk and adversity, may thrive in stressful situations or wither in them, and may be spontaneous and casual, or goal-directed and rather serious. Our instinctual and voluntarily programmed impulses can't be hidden or resisted, but they can take on slightly different forms depending on our unique personalities. Admittedly, reading facial expressions and body language is a skill that takes time and patience to master. there are no quick and easy tricks to understanding people's deeper motivations. However, remember the above principles and focus on honing your powers of observation, and you'll soon develop a knack for seeing and understanding even tiny ripples and flutters of behavior you might have previously missed. We live in a world dominated by words and language, but when you become a student of nonverbal communication, it's no exaggeration to say that you open yourself up to an entirely different, sometimes quite strange world.
Hello, listeners. This is Russell with Newton Media Group, and I want to thank you for the time you've spent listening to the Social Skills Coaching Podcast. It's been a pleasure presenting Patrick King's material, and I hope you found it useful. I want to let you know that we're producing another podcast for you to check out, The Art and Science of Self-Growth, written by Peter Hollins and produced by Newton Media Group. We'll have some bonus material in the next few episodes from that new podcast, and hope you'll find it informative and helpful. Check out the show notes for the anchor.fm link, or search your podcast provider for The Art and Science of Self-Growth by Peter Hollins. Before we get to that bonus audio, let me ask you a question. How often do you experience low energy or fatigue, erectile dysfunction, low sex drive, anxiety, brain fog, or even just have a hard time making decisions? These are all symptoms of a hormonal imbalance. And here's a stat for you. 1 in 4 men over 30 have hormonal imbalances and are low in testosterone. This condition is often misdiagnosed. I'd like to introduce you to our sponsor, Let's Get Checked, a company with the mission to make professional health testing easily accessible. Their fast, affordable, and confidential at-home male hormone test kits help you take a measured approach to your health and measure your hormone levels from the comfort of your home. Even better, Let's Get Checked customers can get 20% off by using this URL, trylgc.com/NMG. That's N as in Newton, M as in media, G as in group. It's really easy. Here's how it works. Go to trylgc.com/NMG. Choose your test online and it'll be delivered to you in discreet packaging with next day delivery. Activate your test online and collect your sample one morning. Return the sample using the prepaid shipping label provided. Once your sample arrives in the lab, results will be available from your online account within 2 to 5 days. You'll get results on 5 hormonal levels: testosterone, sex hormone binding globulin, prolactin, estrogen, and your free androgen index, all without ever having to go to a doctor's office or a laboratory. I've recently experienced my own kind of brain fog and low energy. I was very interested in my hormone levels, and I can't think of a better way than was offered with Let's Get Checked. Everything needed was in the kit with step-by-step instructions. It only took 10 or 15 minutes for the whole process. This testing isn't just for men who think they're in a funk. All men should be testing their hormone levels on a regular basis. Let's Get Checked labs are CLIA approved, and all data is completely anonymized. Get 20% off at trylgc.com/NMG. That's trylgc.com/NMG. N as in Newton, M as in media, G as in group. Now, back to the episode and that bonus material from the new podcast, The Art and Science of Self-Growth by Peter Hollins.
Pyramidal thinking. When we put off our work, it's often because we have too little energy to do what needs to be done. When we experience our work as draining, we're too tired to focus, we're easily distracted, and we feel like we can't accomplish the job we've been assigned. What we're really experiencing is a lack of attention to the underlying energy pyramid that powers us all. This is a bigger problem than we realize, because even more so than time, energy is a finite resource that we must protect on a daily basis. Nothing else you read in this book will make an iota of difference if you don't have the energy to pull it off. Energy drains, and once it does, recharging is necessary. One great tool to understand energy management is the energy pyramid,
an idea conceived by Tim Lohr and Tony Schwartz in The Power of Full Engagement, Managing Energy, Not Time, is the key to high performance and personal renewal. The energy pyramid is a four-tiered pyramid with physical energy at its base, emotional energy above that, mental energy in the next layer, and spiritual energy at the top. Each of these plays an important role in building up or draining our energy, and each tier depends upon the tiers below to sustain itself. Understanding the interconnected nature of what goes into our energy bank allows us to take charge and create more for ourselves. Put another way, if you don't satisfy these levels of energy and engagement, it's unlikely that you will even be in a position to focus, work, or conquer procrastination. The energy pyramid sets forth a model of energy management that will follow for the rest of the book, for the most part. The pyramid points out that we must first notice and improve our levels of physical energy. Physical energy forms the basis for all the other tiers. It's the foundation upon which all our energy needs are built. To manage our physical energy, we must mind our physical health. We must eat healthy, get enough sleep, and exercise. That may sound draining, and sometimes it is. After all, if you're not used to eating vegetables, indigestion will be the initial response to your newly healthy habit. But with time and persistence, eating well pays off with adjusted gut flora and an excess of energy. Exercise works the same way. At first, exercising feels draining, and we finish our routines exhausted. But after we've done it for a week or two, we start to feel energized when we're finished. What used to be difficult becomes easy, and when it does, it comes with a burst of fresh energy to apply to the rest of our lives. Sleep, at least, is an activity that always feels good when we're doing it. While plenty of us wish we didn't need to sleep and could keep working without respite, it's a non-negotiable fact of life that humans need rest. Without sleep, we yawn, have trouble focusing, and eventually fall asleep amidst our required activities. By contrast, when we put effort into getting enough sleep, we're energized, ready for our day, able to focus, and unlikely to fall into an ill-timed slumber. The best part about the physical foundation of the energy pyramid is that it's not an absolute scale. We don't have to become as athletic as teenagers, as health-conscious as dietitians, or as well-rested as Winnie the Pooh to benefit from healthy changes. All we have to do is find room for improvement, then improve. The benefits are almost immediate, and noticing and focusing on how much better minding our health makes us feel can motivate us to continue. Once we start improving our physical health, we'll have the energy to consider the next level of the pyramid, emotional energy. Tending to our physical needs first is essential because our emotions depend upon our physical health. When we're too tired or hungry or malnourished to think clearly, we simply can't focus on emotional pursuits. Emotional energy is simply being in a healthy state of mind, or at least not being bogged down by negative feelings. Emotions that don't result directly from our physiological state can help or hinder our ability to work as well. Positive emotions like joy, anticipation, excitement, or even feeling challenged increase our engagement and our energy. By contrast, negative emotions like anxiety, frustration, sadness, anger, and bitterness crush us like heavy weights. When we're overcome by these emotions, it's difficult to focus on our work and apply ourselves. But emotions aren't things we consciously choose. Sometimes we're anxious when we know we'll be fine, and sometimes we're angry when we know we have no right to feel mad. Sometimes terrible things happen, and we feel sad or wronged. But even when negative emotions are justified, they don't help us learn, grow, and add value to the world. The best weapon against these modern monsters is reframing.
When you face a challenge you don't think you can overcome, don't lament the inevitability of failure, but think about how much you can learn and grow even if you lose. After all, it's exactly those sorts of failures that form the foundation of success. No one accomplishes everything on the first attempt. Failure is what teaches us to do differently in the future. a sense of being wronged, and a base desire for revenge against the universe is one of the more common negative emotions that can be easily overcome by a shift in focus. The majority of what's happening to anyone is never bad. It's neutral, and you can make the internal choice as to its role in your life. Feeling good is essential to doing good. Focusing on those tiny gifts and cultivating gratitude goes a long way toward making us emotionally healthy. To feel good, we have to be willing to let go of negative emotions and be grateful for the positive aspects of all things. Happiness flows freely when we do our part, and when we're happy, we're both more energetic and better at finishing our tasks. Mental energy is the third tier of the energy pyramid. For us to be mentally energetic, we must first be emotionally and physically energized. Otherwise, our exhaustion or unhappiness will be too difficult to overcome. Mental energy relates to everything about our conscious thoughts, being able to remain focused and disciplined despite distractions and temptations. This tier asks us to take control of our thoughts. Instead of passively accepting the first thought that comes to mind, we can assess our thoughts and respond to them in order to consciously choose what we think. Mental energy is about getting the mental muscles and skills we can exercise in getting things done and achieving goals. An important part of building mental energy is to enter into tasks with optimism. When we begin with a negative outlook, we presume we will fail. For example, children often won't try new foods because they don't look tasty. Even if we can convince kids to try food despite their initial judgment, they won't like the taste either. They'd already made up their mind that the food wasn't good, which is the reason they disliked it. But the opposite is also true. When kids look at food and think they might like it, or when they're convinced to withhold judgment, they often enjoy new foods. It's the same with adults and tasks we need to complete. When we go in excited to show what we can do, we often do a superb job. If we go in presuming we'll fail, it's hard to produce any work at all. On top of that, we're drumming up fear from our previous tier while we tell ourselves our efforts aren't going to work. Aside from optimism, several tools can boost our mental energy. Self-talk, where we engage in dialogue with ourselves, can dismiss less helpful thoughts and give us truer narratives to believe. Visualizing the completed project can give a sense of reality to the finished process, and meditation uses our minds to calm the tension we retain physically and emotionally. Even managing our time better can come into play at this level of the energy pyramid, as our minds are what we use to schedule our time and assess how long tasks could and should take. When we manage our time, guide our emotions, and make sure our thoughts are helping instead of hindering us, we'll have more energy and find it easier to face the tasks before us. After our minds are managed, we face the peak of the pyramid, spiritual energy. This isn't a religious tier. Rather, it encourages us to understand our core values and to align our actions with those values. For example, a person who values helping people might do excellently in healthcare jobs, but flounder horribly in sales jobs, because their values are met in one career path but not in the other. The spiritual tier is about finding purpose and passion in what we do, which are the best motivators that exist. They only occur when our actions are aligned with our core values. To capture and increase spiritual energy, we must seek activities that get us closer to our core values and passions, and avoid activities that do the opposite. When we're doing what we feel is important, there's strong motivation to keep going and to feel proud and validated when we accomplish tasks. Physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual energy are all part of the first principle of energy management. When we attain everything the pyramid implies, we're certain to be bursting with energy, but we won't yet know how to direct and manage that energy effectively. In fact, we may be so enthusiastic about what we're doing that we risk burnout. How do we avoid that? With the second principle, every time we use energy, we must allow for its renewal. No one, no matter how much energy they possess, can keep going at full bore forever. Rest is necessary, not just for our physical bodies, but also for our minds and hearts. When we don't take a break from what we do, we eventually become stressed out and frustrated. These negative emotions are often accompanied by negative thoughts. Both will sap energy quickly. To prevent this, we must disengage regularly so that our minds can heal. Overuse, even overuse of energy, leads to destruction of the resource that's being overused. Rest is what allows us to heal and grow stronger. Contrasting with the second principle, the third principle of energy management reminds us that pushing past our limits is necessary for growth. We can't just sit idly, work repetitively and consistently, and expect to improve. We must regularly challenge ourselves if we want to grow. Dancers know this very well. Everyone shows up to their first class barely able to point their toes. But pushing allows muscles to grow stronger and the body to take new forms. Sometimes it takes years of persistent effort to reach our true goals, but the way to get there is always by setting up a challenge and getting closer and closer as our bodies, emotions, minds, and spirits allow. Even non-physical tasks require us to push ourselves into discomfort, as anyone who's done a bit of public speaking will know. Most are terrified the first few times, and often that terror is discernible to the audience. Speakers will shake, stutter, and go over sections of their speech multiple times. At first, it feels like it will never get better, but persistence makes the nervous speaker reattempt their task despite the difficulty. Slowly, giving speeches becomes easier. Eventually, the truly persistent will discover that it's an enjoyable activity. But none of that is possible without feeling spurred on to succeed by the challenge of public speaking. At every level, we benefit from challenging ourselves and pushing ourselves into new and difficult circumstances. The fourth and final principle of energy management states that we must create energy rituals to sustain full engagement. Despite the human ability to think and choose, most of our actions are based on habit. What we do, we usually don't think about. What we have to think about, we usually don't do, at least not for very long. That means it's essential to transform energy-sustaining practices into persistent activities so we don't have to remember or talk ourselves into helpful habits. This will come as no surprise to anyone who's dieted in their life. Generally speaking, any short-term starvation will lead to eating in our habitual way once we shed the weight. What happens next? The weight comes back, and we have to diet again. This pattern is particularly damaging, as each time we fail to make a real and lasting change in our life, the return of the old actions and their consequences feels more and more inevitable. It's not inevitable, but avoiding the trap involves making real, permanent changes. The new way has to be sustainable. In short, it has to become a habit. 2 months of consistently performing any action will generally turn it into a habit. But until we reach that point, we have to put active effort into creating a new routine. We must make a choice not to eat certain foods, to exercise, or to drink a certain amount of water. But commitment and consistency is only needed at first. Eventually, thinking becomes unnecessary. We'll have the rituals in place to be healthy, happy, and effective at our work. Once we have the habits to maximize our productivity, and once we become used to challenging ourselves and resting to recharge our batteries, it becomes easier to direct our energy in any way we need. When we have enough energy, even the tasks we like to avoid become easy to face. This has been Endless Energy, a blueprint for productivity, focus, and self-discipline for the perpetually tired and lazy. Written by Peter Hollins, narrated by Russell Newton. Copyright 2019 by Peter Hollins. Production copyright by Peter Hollins.